This is WCPO FM 1051 on your FM dial, Cincinnati, Ohio.
WKRC, Cincinnati.
This is the Nation Station.
Hi again, everyone, and welcome to the Cincy Shirts Podcast. It's episode 45, like a brimful of Asha. Today on our show, illustrator and industrial designer Chris Reef.
In the early days of it, there was a small group of us that were kind of all like on the same track at the same time, like trying to figure that stuff out. Like what's the Stormtrooper blaster made out of? I want a Stormtrooper blaster. How can I make one? Well, the base guns, this British submachine gun, then scopes that came out of tanks, and a box on the side that's a electromechanical counter out of old machinery.
Now, as that poll indicates, Chris is involved heavily in the Star Wars universe for like his day job. I mean, it's his actual job. He creates what can best be described as manuals for all the Star Wars technology, particularly the Millennium Falcon. And he talks about how he got into that line of work, visiting Skywalker Ranch, and how it's sometimes difficult to just let fictional technology from other fandoms simply entertain him without trying to dissect them. So be sure to listen for the promo code at the end of the episode. As always, you can save 20% on your next Cincy Shirts or OldSchoolShirts.com order with that discount code. Now let's talk to Chris Reef.
Cincinnati, Ohio. Cincinnati, Ohio.
I come from
C-I-N-C-I-N-N-A-T-I, Cincinnati.
She came down from Cincinnati. Just maybe think of me once in a while. I'm at
CincyShirts.com in Cincinnati.
How many of those have you done, those types of books of the owner's manual?
We did a Falcon owner's manual and then a Death Star owner's manual.
I thought there was a Death Star one.
And this is the redo of the Falcon one.
For a like solo.
Putting all the solo stuff. Because it's changed a bunch and there's new... There's new floor plan stuff because we're seeing new rooms now.
Are there Phillips head screws, or is it something like the Phillips head screws?
That looks too standard earthly. It's always hex head.
There was a Star Trek one when I was a kid.
Okay, we don't talk about that.
The burgundy one?
And no, it was blue.
Oh, blue.
It was all the blueprints of all the ships.
Oh, for the original series.
Yeah, TOS.
Yeah, I've got that one.
Cool. Yeah, my mom probably pitched mine.
Like every good old Star Wars or Star Trek or any kind of toy.
My brother built a model of the Enterprise when he was 10, and I went up in the attic, and he got remarried, and I thought, I ran up to Cleveland, went up into the attic, and this is going to be his wedding present, his old Enterprise. Nope, gone. Long gone.
You're going to re-gift him his Enterprise?
No. He probably thought it was long gone. He thought it was gone forever. He built it when he was...
It was long gone.
It was, yeah. He was probably 12 when he built it, and he must have been a little older. He was before he left for the Navy,
That's cool.
Yeah.
And it had the tester glue?
Tester's glue, it was AMT.
Always, like, dripping over the sides.
AMT Enterprise model.
The big tube of gel glue.
Oh, yeah.
Or I was like the...
worth of shit.
The metallic, it was like paint, model paint in a marker.
Oh, yeah.
I'd always sit there and be like, okay, I'm going to do this little area, just like, you know, make it all metallic and shiny. And then pretty soon the whole damn jet was just, you know, looked like the Tin Man, looked ridiculous. And
I've got the very first model kit I ever built. I built it with my dad. He'd go on business trips for IBM and he'd come back with a present from wherever he was. And this one, he bought a model kit of the airplane he was on.
It was like
an American Airlines thing. But...
Is that what
American,
got you hooked?
American Airlines at the time was like they were flying polished aluminum planes. So I got this thing. And then like sat there with a brush painting silver. Like the entire thing's brush painted silver.
No spray paint?
Wow.
not then, no.
I was at the kitchen table. Can I take some pictures of this and put it online? Is this a secret?
No, it's announced and online and stuff.
Awesome.
I think the only model my dad and I ever built was a General Lee Dukes of Hazzard car. Everything else he brought home were toys.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Are you a Cincinnati guy?
I am. I grew up in Mason.
All right. So. What did you want to be? Like, what did you go to school for?
Where'd you go to school?
How far back do you want to go? Grade school was St. Susanna in Mason.
Then St. X for high school.
Okay.
And then up to Miami University for college. But in high school, my art teacher was amazing, and she really got me excited and encouraged about the stuff. And I built up a great portfolio in high school and got scholarships to college because of it, both to XU and to Miami. And I chose Miami and ended up there. And I couldn't, at the time, I really couldn't decide whether I wanted to go pre-med and do like emergency medicine, like an ER doc, or okay. if I wanted to go just straight up art and be that. So I found out right around the time I was starting college, somebody mentioned medical illustration and okay. where like drawing pictures of hearts and like how to do surgeries and all sorts of stuff and making prosthetics, all sorts of that stuff. And I got super excited about that and like went up to University of Michigan and talked to their graduate program people about that and was kind of setting my course that way. And when I went to Miami, they didn't have an illustration program per se. So I had to kind of figure that out. And I worked with one of the professors up there and kind of created an illustration program. And he recommended like basically a double concentration or major in painting.
Why didn't you go to art school?
And graphic design. So what school?
I said, why didn't you go to art school?
Oh, art school. Well, I didn't want an art school degree. I wanted a more.
Yeah. Darren, what was your if you hadn't gone art, what would you have, what
probably
was your backup?
A good call. Culinary. I would have been a chef, I think, or a DJ. but I went with art.
That's school. About as yeah. That's about the two sides of the coin. Like
yeah, I was gonna make sure I could feed myself.
But, so you went to art school.
yeah, exactly. Yeah. Hey, I'm eating pretty good, buddy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. All right, so you get into the art field.
Yeah.
And when did the Star Wars thing,
it was always there. I mean, anybody our age grew up with it. So right. it was always that. And had the closet full of toys and while I was in college, like that's when like the new Zahn books came out. And like,
yeah.
it was like, oh crap, there's a new one. And like,
yeah.
that day was done. And like, grab the book and like, just lay in the dorm and read the book all day, skip classes and all that stuff.
But, yeah.
So yeah, and then, Star Wars was always cool.
It's such the cool thing now. But you know,
I mean, the toys started coming back then. And I was driving from Oxford down to Hamilton to go to the Meijer down there and shop for muscly Luke and Leia figures.
Oh yeah, the power of the Force.
Yeah.
Oh man, yeah. That every figure in that series, everybody's jacked up.
Mm-hmm.
It's hilarious.
It's horrible. I love them now though, just because they're so bizarre. And
right.
They were for so many people. Like they were the turning point that got everybody back into stuff.
Yeah.
Just like we were so starved for any Star Wars thing.
Yes. When I was born, my dad worked at Ford. He was a machinist at Ford. And then when I was maybe two or three, he went to Kenner. And then he was a model maker at Kenner until I was probably 16. And so Star Wars has always been not just like part of my childhood, but it was always like my connection to my dad.
Right.
It was like everything Star Wars, like even just like seeing the logo, like would evoke these feelings of like being a kid. And he'd come home from the toy fair in New York, and he'd mm-hmm. you know, he'd bring me a new toy, but I got more excited about like the catalog, like the toy catalog that showed everything that was coming out the next year.
Right.
Like just being able to know what was coming out, you know. And then like, you know, people would come, Kenner would come to our my elementary school
and do the career day talk kind of stuff.
Well, like they would do, like they would show new toys to kids and get feedback. Okay. Yeah, yeah. But I was never allowed to do it. Like I was the one kid
who wasn't
allowed because you know my dad worked for a toy company. But Star Wars, like above all the stuff I collected, and I collected everything that Kenner made, but Star Wars was always like just forefront. I mean, I think it was partly my age and, you know, the timing of the movies coming out. But, you know, to this day, it's still like probably my biggest passion is right. all things Star Wars. But like how you adapted your background in art and your, I mean, I don't want to mislabel it. You could probably do it, Darren, a better job than I could of saying of what this
super
is.
Super technical, tight, mechanical, scientific. Well,
it's a weird, absurd, like pseudo-engineered, like everything. Like, yeah, it's something that my illustration partner Chris Travis and I kind of specialize in, and that's this weird world of making it look like it's real tech when it's all made up. It's right. You look at the engine and stuff in there we'll have hour long conversations on the phone about like just the stupidest stuff, like how the shield generator works and where the power's coming from it. And and how our diagrams and illustrations and fuel flow indicators and all that should work.
And what we're talking about
actually happens
for everybody that's listening. We're going to put some pictures of this and a lot of links up on the blog because this is my day to absolutely nerd out on the Cincy Shirts podcast. But it's the owner's manual for the Millennium Falcon, which was updated to be sort of backdated in a weird way. You know, you had done one for the Millennium Falcon we all know from the original trilogy. And this has got the updates for the Solo movie, but it's basically the owner's manual for the Millennium Falcon. So when you're working on something like this and you have those conversations about, you know, like how to replace the cabin air filter in the Millennium Falcon or something, do you have that kind of freedom? Is that something you have to run by? Do you just brainstorm like how it would work or do you pull things from actual?
Well, we've been doing this for 25 years or so and know the folks at Lucasfilm and kind of we have a good feel for how they're thinking, where they want to go with stuff, what they don't want to touch on, like the stories they want to kind of leave empty right now so that there's room to expand for them.
Yeah.
But there's also stuff that they don't care about and not that they don't care about, but they don't care that we get to play in that part of it.
Yeah.
And they like the style we've got and what we do and how much thought we put into it. So we've got a really great relationship and it gets approved, but a lot of it is like, oh, you guys did this? Okay. It's the nod of like, they know that we care.
You're like three steps ahead of them probably.
Yeah. And one of our favorite stories is that years and years ago, we did a series of blueprints of Star Wars ships for DK Publishing. They were big fold out posters, like 24x36 posters.
They made those in the t-shirts, right?
Or maybe there were some that got made into shirts, yeah. And we had, as part of that, we were doing a little data block in the bottom corner of the blueprint to say how big the ship was and like
scale,
more like significant specs on it. And it had been a long time since anybody done that for the Millennium Falcon. Well, as part of our drawings, like we were showing the inside and like side views and like in doing that, like you know how tall Harrison Ford is and you know how big he looks in the tube going up to the cockpit in the movie.
Yeah.
So you had to fit that tube in the outside of the ship and getting all that stuff scaled, then the ship had to be a certain size.
Right.
Is that your first measurement to figure out the scale?
How big Harrison Ford was, yeah. So we have our little standard 6-foot man in those blueprints. And that let us figure out exactly how long the Falcon was because we had really accurate data from 3D scans of the models and stuff of the outside of the ship. So we could figure out exactly how long it was. And we went, but we struggled because the official size of the Falcon was, 78 feet or something like that long. And we just struggled and struggled because there was no way it was ever going to fit. He'd be, the top of the Falcon would be, chest high on Harrison Ford if it was truly that long.
Yeah.
So we put this multi-page email together to the folks at Lucasfilm and said here's all our reasoning and why we think it needs to be this big and here's how big, we worked it out to 113.8 feet, which in Star Wars world, 1138 is kind of a weird number that shows up everywhere because Lucas is THX 1138. But it was completely coincidental. We did the math, and that's where it fell. So we sent that out to him.
Who are these guys?
Wait, where did the 78 feet come from?
That was from some previous stuff. Part of it was based off of they built a
legend.
They built a 3/4. So the full size Falcon that you see in the movies isn't full size. It's 3/4 size or 70%. I forget exactly how big, but I think that measurement came off of that.
Oh, okay.
And since that was the full size one, I mean, that's where that number came from. But it doesn't work when you start putting the interior in it.
That's amazing.
And they emailed back and said, well, you guys have thought about this way more than we have. So we'll go with what you say. But let's make it 114 instead of 1138.
Because it's too.
Because it sounds made up.
Yeah, it's too on the nose. Yeah.
So what? All right. So I guess we jumped forward to working with Lucasfilm and all that stuff. Like, obviously, you were a Star Wars nerd before you started doing this stuff. So there had to have been some sort of amazing phone call or letter or email or how did you start working
with Lucasfilm?
Yeah, how'd you go? Because it seems like there's so much.
How'd you go from fan? Because I love these stories.
There's so much great fan art out there. Yeah. And now you're taking fan art to, sounds like,
getting paid. Well, I mean, my path is, as most people who end up doing this stuff for a living, most people's paths are non-standard. And mine's no exception. I started
at the art school in Miami.
Yeah. Yeah, I got a graphic design degree.
So you're screwed up from the start
Like, it was an amazing program, but, like, I wanted to do illustration and had no idea really what I was going to do. Like, I was figuring freelance illustration, and then I got through one of my professors at Miami, got put in contact with a toy product development consultancy here in Cincinnati that were ex-Kenner guys, and they were looking for somebody who could draw. So I got put in touch with them, went and interviewed and started working there like 3 days later, and spent the next decade of my life doing toy design and product development with those guys. And they were the guys, Jim Swearingen, Tim Effler, and Tom Osborne had formed this company, Soda. And I started working for them, and it was the four of us doing stuff for years. But they were the original Star Wars guys at Kenner. And if anybody's seen the toys that made us, Jim's a huge part of the Star Wars episode. Yeah.
He's actually doing cons now.
He is. He's going around. He's having a fun time.
Awesome. I'm dying to get him on this podcast, too.
I'm sure he'd come on.
Even just to shake his hand and talk about my dad for a little bit. But, yeah.
But I worked for those guys for a decade. And somewhere in working with them, like, we were doing a lot of Star Wars product, and I met people at Lucasfilm.
You were doing Star Wars product through this local company?
Through Soda,
company? Okay.
So we were creating ideas and selling ideas into companies like Kenner or doing product development for Kenner. Okay. And I painted a lot of samples for Episode One toys. We did design work, like
late 90s.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah. We did a bunch of work on the big queen ship playset.
Yeah.
We did Star Wars mini helmets for Riddell, like little 45% scale mini helmets, Riddell, the football helmet. Yeah, people football came helmets, to us and said, and the guys at Riddell that were doing product development, and the president of Riddell at the time knew the Soda guys from their time that Kenner all shared. So it came to us to like help them figure out a new product to do for, instead of football helmets, what can we do?
Yeah.
And at the time they were doing miniature football helmets, and me being the Star Wars nerd, I said, hey, let's do Star Wars helmets. So I mocked up miniature Star Wars helmets out of like sheet styrene and football helmets. And we pitched the idea. They loved it. We started doing Star Wars helmets. And that was kind of the first big Star Wars project where I went out and met people at Lucasfilm. And we ended up in the archives looking at original helmets.
So what's that like, man? Like, what's that like? I mean, what was it like to just get that first call? Like Darren said, that you're going to be working on some Star Wars stuff. Even just the local stuff, let alone going out to Lucasfilm.
I guess we're doing this now. I mean, it was one of those kind of things where it was like, all right, just on the roller coaster. This is just the next hill we're going down. Like,
that's insane.
How about when you're like, I'm going to get a paycheck?
Yeah, exactly. It's like, what, people get paid to do this? It's like, all right, that's fun. And then you realize, I mean, it's all work. Like, there are still days where, like, you've just had enough of the Millennium Falcon. Like, oh, my God, I do not want to draw another Switch. I don't want to figure out how this escape pod system works.
Like, does.
Why couldn't they just make it easy? No, they had to make the escape pod load sideways. Now we got to figure out a mechanism to twist it and unload it and put it where this is. And, like, oh, my God.
Anybody that's into this is not feeling sorry for you. Right?
I know. Yeah. No, nobody should.
I'm done.
My worst most hectic, horrible days are still better than most people's best days.
That's what I say about comedy. The worst day of stand-up is better than the best day of any other job I've ever had.
Yeah.
I agree. So,
and it's, like, so much of it, especially in the Star Wars world, is it's the people, too, like, that we're working with. Like, the people at Lucasfilm, like, the story group folks and publishing and a product approval people, like I've known them for so long, and they're, like, they're just good people. Like, they're the people I want to go to conventions and hang out, like, at the bar with, drinking and just telling stories about life. Like, it's not, I mean, family's a good way to describe it. It's like, I mean, they are. Like, they're an extended family for me. And it's been that way, just kind of developed naturally over the years. It's awesome.
I think that the way I initially met you was on Facebook, and I don't remember how I found your profile, but it either had something to do with your working R2-D2 that you show up with around the city at various events, or I want to say I might have read an article or seen something online about a gun you had made, like a blaster or something.
Stormtrooper blaster, probably. I just finished a Han Solo blaster.
Okay.
I should have brought that today so you guys could play.
Oh, but, my gosh.
Yeah, what the heck? Holding out.
So,
I don't know, transporting guns around.
Yeah. On election day.
Yeehaw!
So,
18, you can vote, and...
Hey, a good guy with a blaster.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Makes all the difference.
My favorite line. Yeah. My absolute favorite line.
So, you've got your hand in, like, actual models of helmets. You've got your hand in drawings. You've got your hand in toys. You've got your hand in replicas. You've got your hand in droids. Like, what is your favorite thing to do of all that stuff?
It depends on the day. It really does. I mean, the book stuff, the illustration, and the CAD work, like, that sort of thing, like, I love doing that stuff, which is great because that's how I make a living, is doing that stuff. But when things get super stressful for me, the ways I detox and kind of recenter myself are, like, I want to get my hands on something. So, like, that's when I build props, replica prop stuff, is to kind of recenter myself and do, instead of being hands on a mouse and working digital, it's like having, like, standing at a lathe, making a part for a replica. And, like, doing big muscle movement stuff is, like, that's kind of the detox release thing.
Yeah. You just go to Lowe's and just walk up and down the aisle, like, oh, I bet I could make
sometimes.
Something this really? Or that.
Yeah, like, here's a shower head, and that makes a good lightsaber emitter. Yeah, like, so, I mean, most of the stuff I do is replica stuff. So, it's...
Was there an article in the paper about you doing that kind of work?
Probably.
I feel like that's how I first
So my illustration partner, Chris Travis, that I did this book with, he and I met years and years ago before we ever worked together through replica prop stuff. Like, I got a Graflex flash, like, back in the day, like, found out, oh, hey, like, this Luke's lightsaber was made out of a flash handle. Like, went and camera show, found one. And then got on the internet back before there were groups like the RPF.
Yeah.
And posted to, like, rec.arts.sci-fi.props or whatever it was. And
You're going real deep tracks with that kind
of
thing.
Well, and I just posted, like, does anybody know where I can get parts to turn this camera flash into a lightsaber? And Chris was the first person to respond. And, like, shared a PDF or something, or I don't even know. It was probably, like, a low-res GIF of how to make a lightsaber at the time. But
it took you 3 hours to download a 1 megabyte
image. Yeah, like, over my 1400 baud modem, yeah. And then, like, we met through that and started researching the parts that go into making Star Wars props. And started a website for ourselves to kind of document that stuff called The Parts of Star Wars.
And were these people who just that just sort of figured out on their own, like, you can make it using this, or were these, like,
there was
ideas borrowed from, like, you know, ILM or something?
Yes. In the early days of it, there was a small group of us that were kind of all, like, on the same track at the same time, like, trying to figure that stuff out, like. Like, what's the Stormtrooper blaster made out of? I want a Stormtrooper blaster. How can I make one? Well, the base gun's this British submachine gun, and then scopes that came out of tanks, and
a box on the side that's a electromechanical counter out of old machinery. Like, so there, like we were this whole community of people, and it was the early days of the RPF. Like, the replica prop forum online started through a friend of ours, Brandon Allinger, who now runs a prop store selling prop replicas.
Yeah.
But he started the replica prop forum because he had a site where he was doing the kind of the same thing we were at the same time. Like lightsaber handles this with these things and like this circuit board here. Like, and then he started a discussion forum online that turned into the replica prop forum. But yeah. it was all that sort of stuff. And it's like, and we started the Parts of Star Wars as a repository for, like, we were figuring out all this stuff and other people were coming to us with data.
Yeah.
And it was trying to put all of it in one spot because we couldn't remember it all. But a place that we could both update and reference when we needed to, when we were out at the flea market looking for junk in a box of metal. I mean,
wow.
And that, like, that relationship with Chris and that hobby kind of led to some of the early Star Wars illustration work for me. Chris had been doing illustration work as long as I had been doing toy design stuff at the time.
Okay.
For, like, West End Games and stuff. But then a big job came up, the blueprints, and he wasn't going to be able to do it on his own, but he and I were working so well together. Like, we did that project together. And then that kind of tech nerdy level project led to all this other stuff since then. So,
oh my gosh, man,
it's like I said, it's not a straight path. It's there's not an easy answer to any of it.
Yeah.
It's a big long-winded story of how to get from A to B.
But you got started, like you said, when, you know, there was like no, there, like me anyway, I was starved for Star Wars.
It was the dead years.
You know what I mean? And so what was, you know, I tell this story. My dad, Return of the Jedi was the first movie that I was able to see of the Star Wars trilogy in the theater. Like, I was old enough to go to the theater to see mm-hmm. it. And I remember my dad had early tickets because they gave a bunch of tickets to Kenner employees. And, like, I thought I was, like, the coolest thing ever because I got to see Return of the Jedi before any of my friends. And then when Episode 1 came out, I was a movie critic for the Northerner, the NKU newspaper. And so I got tickets to see Phantom Menace before anybody else as part of my screener status. And I got to take my dad to see Episode 1.
Nice.
So it was like really cool for me to
give back.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you know, and all the way, you know, like that's kind of the bittersweetness of like everything that's going on with Star Wars now is that he's not with us anymore and I don't get to share it with him, but I have a 7-year-old son who's super into it. So we go to the celebrations and we, you know,
yeah, like, it's multi-generational.
It really is. Yeah. And it's like, it's almost like a passing of the torch type deal.
Well, I feel like that's the reason Star Wars is never going to go away, because it's made that multi-generational jump now. And it's like, as soon as it does that, where like parents are passing it on to kids and kids are passing it on to their kids, it's like, then like, yeah, it's like staying forever.
But do you see, you know, like, the prequels came out and they were really chastised by the hardcore fans. You know what I mean? And then now it's almost become that the Star Wars fans are their own worst enemy for being able to just enjoy the fact that we have so much of this stuff out there. Like,
or the Russian trolls.
Is that what you think it is? Is there a conspiracy that the Russians...
Didn't they say that like that was some of the like the harsh criticism from...
So they got Last Trump Jedi elected was, and they trashed the Last Jedi on Rotten Tomatoes.
Russians are ruining everything.
Everything that's good. That's hilarious.
That's nuts.
But, you know, I don't know, like... There did seem to be a part with the toys specifically where it kind of jumped the shark, where it's like, okay, like this stuff is everywhere. Like, I just remember seeing it.
Well, yeah, they had a huge problem with Episode 1 in that, well, I mean, it was just a train wreck across the board on product and everything else, because there weren't, I mean, my personal opinion is I feel like no one was telling George no.
Yeah.
I feel like he had, like, over the years, like, had surrounded himself by a bunch of fans and yes people. And when it came time to do the movie, for one, and then to do product and everything else, nobody wanted to be the person saying no. everybody wanted to be saying yes and then be able to take credit for the success of things later.
Right.
And no one said this is a bad idea. Like this horrible racial stereotype character that's not really a racial stereotype. It's just like a just junky stereotype of nothing in particular, but just horrible.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, let's make him a main thing. Like, nobody ever said that's this might be overplaying things. Like, yeah. Nobody said that sort of stuff. And I feel like there's so much good idea stuff there, but there wasn't enough editing of the good ideas.
Yeah, then the CGI was just, like, so over the top, you know, because I felt like one of the things J.J. Abrams did with The Force Awakens that I really liked was there was, like, actual sets being built. You know what I mean?
Well, and, even for episode one, like, everybody talks about how much CG stuff there was, but there were, like, well, George talked about how proud he was of all the CG stuff. And, like, would show reels, and half the reel was physical models from the model shop at ILM.
Oh, really?
So, there's been a misperception over the years that episode one was so much CG, and it actually used as much model work as any of the original trilogy stuff did.
Huh.
Like, I think they probably built more physical models for episode one than they built for
the classic
trilogy.
Maybe it just felt that way because it was so busy, you know, with, like, giant armies and hundreds of ships instead of, like, you know, felt like there's three or four.
I feel like the character stuff, like Jar Jar and a bunch of the other aliens that were all CG, like, those overplayed the CG stuff. And I feel like they just got so much attention that it distracted from the other stuff. But, like, I mean, like, pod racers and stuff, like, those things were physical models, and they'd go out and fling them out into the desert and destroy them and tumble them and take photos. Like,
That's so cool. The
pod race arena was, yeah, like, a giant physical model with Q-tips for people, and, they're beautiful.
That's amazing.
I feel like...
Are you going to a pod racer owner's manual?
Not that's currently on the schedule, but
what is there something that you really want to do? You're waiting for the go ahead. Are you allowed to share it?
I can't.
Slave One?
I can't talk about them yet. But
Death Star exists.
Yeah, so
There are plans for others, and we're working on ones now. So,
do you work on anything that's not out yet that we haven't seen?
Yep. The stuff we work on.
How far ahead are you,
publishing wise? I mean, the book we're working on now will probably wrap art and text end of December, beginning of January, and then it'll probably be out March or April.
Oh wow, that fast!
Yeah, so publishing can spin pretty quick. Product wise, I mean, you tend to work 2 years to a year on product development stuff, so toys and other bigger projects.
Are you still working on some of the toy stuff?
Don't really do a lot of the hard product development stuff. I have done some, but most of what we do with Hasbro now is illustration work for packaging.
Okay.
Packaging art.
Because they're doing the vintage collection, which is, like, obviously, for obvious reasons, hits home with me because it's new toys made to look like the old packaging.
Right.
And people are, like, it's blowing up right now.
It is. A lot of what we've done with Hasbro is Black Series stuff, like art for Black Series packaging. Yeah. So,
which is another, like, huge collector.
It is. That's the grown-up toys.
Yeah. Well, and it's, like, the more accurate. And it's why they hired us to do blueprinty sort of stuff for it. It's like, it's a very techy, like, accurate sort of representation of things. So, like, if you see Black Series packaging with blueprints of lightsabers or ships or something on it, I mean, Darth Vader's helmet, whatever it is, that's probably something that Travis or I have done.
What was your favorite thing you've worked on so far? I mean, that you were personally the most excited about, like, I get to name this thing or I get to figure out what this does.
Well, this Falcon book that's just coming out. Yeah,
and this isn't out. It'll be out.
It's available for pre-order. It's probably shipped. I mean, these are books off the production line.
This is a Star Wars YT-1300 Millennium Falcon Owner's Workshop Manual
from Haynes.
And it's the modified Carillion freighter, which is the version that you see in the Solo movie.
Right, and it's Well, and that's just the ship on the cover, but the thing covers the classic trilogy Falcon, Han's ship, and
it's an
update makes it sound like it wasn't that much to do, but it was. It's
no,
a.
No, I just mean.
We redid the entire book, it gave us a chance to go back because the Millennium Falcon one was the first one we did,
and
we've learned a whole lot and developed more systems since then. So it gave us a chance to go back and fix all the little things and add in stuff out of those 4-hour long conversations about
so now the engines. So as like real life technology advances with like I see there's like a navigation system in here and some other things, you know, like with Google and everything that we have on our phones, do you ever try to incorporate do you ever take like real life technology and say, ah, I bet if we applied this to the Falcon, then that might work this way, where 10 years ago.
Well, Darren, this is
that didn't even exist.
This is a long time ago in a galaxy far away. So
we try and stay faithful to what to kind of the style in the in-universe systems that they've established over the years, and all the little like the quirks and weirdnesses that happen. Like try and play in the established universe as much as possible.
Okay,
so it's not like it's
there's
not like,
no pressure.
Hey,
to
now
make
we can hang an iPad on the wall. It's never that sort of thing. But we do like
where they get Amazon
an app
deliveries
for fixing the hyperdrive.
And we try and go back in and address all the little stuff we can. But I mean, to answer your question, like this Falcon book is probably the most fun project. Like, there's a lot of reasons for that. Chris Travis and writer Wyndham that I worked on the book with, and then even the publisher, writer's the author. And the three of us, we love working together. Like we've done promo trips and stuff before, and some of the most fun I've ever had on a trip is hanging out with the two of those guys, just laughing till my eyes hurt. Like I was talking about before, the whole Lucasfilm family, like for this book, because we were working on this before Solo came out, the three of us went out to Lucasfilm and sat down with the story group, with publishing, with the Millennium Falcon guys from ILM, and just talked through everything we wanted to do. There was a script read at the time before the movie came out. The script changed
the director change.
Like, we saw a bunch of the early stuff, and just so we could get, because we needed all this data, because we knew the Falcon was such a huge part of the new movie.
Yeah.
Like, we needed to make sure everything we were going to do and what we were going to do was going to play with the story they were telling, and that we were doing the same stuff, and we weren't gonna step on each other's toes. We were all gonna compliment each other. Like that was that particular experience was a really amazing time. But it's like I said before, the whole family thing where it's like we were just a whole bunch of geeks in a room who loved the Falcon, and we were all excited and talking about the Falcon. And it's like the ILM guys came in, and I think one of them said something like, "Oh, we've been dying to meet you guys," and like. And we're sitting there going, we're dying to meet you guys. It was the big love fest.
Yeah.
And so in this book, what another Star Wars artist had kind of sketched out an idea that like the mandibles on the front of the Falcon, like there's that gap in the middle, that the idea that they were kind of for pushing containers and stuff around. Well, and it's something that a lot of us have been thinking about that for a long time. Like, how to use those. And back in the day, Kenner did a mandible ship that fit in there. It was a proposed line of expansion, but we added that into the first Falcon book, that ship that, and then for this one, I wanted to do the pushing containers around. And we had seen like in the trailer for Solo that there was that big train car thing going by. Well, I had the idea that, well, maybe those train cars, like, we can make those train cars kind of like standard Star Wars container system stuff. Like,
so that, like
intermodal
the train,
freight sort of thing.
So the train in the Solo movie theoretically could fit between the space of the Millennium
Falcon. That was the concept.
Oh, wow.
And, like, just using those is kind of like when you see a truck going down the highway and it's got a cargo container that then goes on a ship or on a train car. It's that
it's like a barge.
Whole intermodal freight thing.
Right.
Like that idea and applying that to Star Wars. So I mentioned that in the meeting, and the ILM guys, we broke for lunch, and they ran back to their to their computers and grabbed the full-size 3D model of the Falcon and the full-size 3D model of the train cars, stuck them together and went, yep, it's the right size, wow. And sent us a quick, like, screenshot of that to verify the size of stuff. And then we ended up working with them and made an illustration in this book that shows that. But it was like everybody was so excited about little nerdy stuff like that.
Yeah.
And it's like
it's almost like an Easter egg, like just hearing you tell that story of like I don't know. I
and there was a we did an email interview thing with for StarWars.com not too long ago. And as part of that we shared a photo that we took that day at Lucasfilm. I think that's online in some of the previews on Amazon, that page. We shared this photo, and it's a photo of all of us from that day, and original ILMers and all of it. I mean, it's just awesome.
Has anything that you and your team have come up with, like, in that same vein, found its way into a movie because of something that you've done, or were you ever consulted on something for a movie that, that they were like, hey, how would this work?
We found out, so...
Because now you set a precedent, like you're providing this information to fans of like, this is how this works. So if the movie does something different, they'd be like, well, this goes against what the Star Wars.
Well, they can always change stuff for the movie, and that there's stuff that changed from our original Falcon book,
based on
what they did for the new movies and how they wanted to tell their stories. Like the engines in the Falcon changed considerably, but now like we've gone back in and worked with them and shown the current Falcon engines. And like I built a big 3D model of the Falcon engines, like insides and reworked how everything flows. Cause you like, there's that scene in Solo where they inject the stuff in the engine. You kind of see it flow through the whole system.
Yeah.
Like they built a 3D model of that. And then I went and rebuilt it because we had to adjust it a little bit for how it was going to fit in our floor plan and stuff.
That's amazing. I'm sorry. That's incredible. Yeah.
It's that sort of thing. But
just for a split second on the screen, and that how many hundreds of hours that.
It was the biggest hunk of work I did, like individual hunk of work I did on this book was building that engine.
Does it run on synthetic oil? This is George Lucas calling you.
Yeah, that's George Lucas calling me. Sorry about that.
Do you have George Lucas's cell phone?
I do not.
Ah.
Nobody call me and ask me for it. I don't have it.
Boba Fett's?
But, yeah, Boba Fett's. His idea. But that in doing all this stuff, like, well, in that meeting, we found out that some of the stuff, the story elements and the way things kind of shaped up for Solo were at least partially based on things we had done for our books and previous stuff. Just little things like the fact that L3 in the new movie, like the type of droid she started life as and how she was going to interface with the computer and the Falcon ultimately. Like they said, oh no, we like that illustration right there. We should just keep that because that's kind of what we used as our inspiration to do this. Like,
What does that feel like to hear that? Even as long as you've been doing it, is it still?
It's you're like, holy crap! Okay, that's fun. Thanks, but it's when they first announced the writer for Rogue One, his Facebook page. He changed the whatever the top image on Facebook is, like the big header image cover photo. He changed his cover photo to a photo of his desk, and right there in the middle of his desk was the
yearbook.
Death Star owner's manual, that he was using as reference. So it's like, that's all awesome. Right.
Have you ever been on the set of any filming?
No, I never have. I hope to someday, but no, never have.
But that's the thing, like, and I don't know if it sticks in the back of your head or not, but it's like, you know, Rogue One, which has become one of my favorite Star Wars films. It was literally born out of one tiny line in the opening crawl of the first Star Wars movie.
Yeah. Right?
It was like, it was just a reference like, oh, this happened, so now this movie can happen, you know?
Right.
And that's why when I heard the plot, I just thought it was so genius of like, they've really shown that you can take any piece of any Star Wars movie and there's a backstory to it somehow. So like, who knows what, you know, all this stuff that you're doing, how it,
right. You know. And it, like, it's like, yeah, I mean, somebody might read through there and get inspired by one little line or, yeah. And that, I mean, that's part of why we spend so much time talking about it and working through things. It's like, we want it to feel rich and like that there's a big background to all this stuff. And if we just like start, like, we don't want it to all be like top level.
Like, yeah.
Like the Millennium Falcon flies on fuel. Like yeah. that doesn't tell the story. Like, it feels more rich to like dive in and figure out how it works. Like even if the particulars of those things are never told in print, like they affect the illustrations we do, like the way we think about things and how different parts of the book tie together. And it's part of what makes it feel real, even though it's not. It's like it's thought out whether or not it's real.
Right. Yeah. But I feel like there's an appreciation.
It's done with confidence, that's for sure.
For the work that you're doing, like, you know, I'm a moderator in this Star Wars autograph universe, which is this big group on Facebook that's all focused on autograph Star Wars stuff. And one thing I've noticed in the last year is that the opportunities to get signatures from ILM guys are just as sought after as like the actors from the movies.
Right.
And I see a lot of these ILM guys showing up at conventions, signing autographs, signing images of, you know, either the ships that they worked on or the concept art that it came from. Is that something that you'd have interest in doing at some point? Do you?
Yeah.
I mean, I know you do the illustrations at Celebration, which is where I first finally met you in person mm-hmm. in Orlando. But is it, like, do you do bookstore tours with this stuff?
We do. Different publishers kind of control that stuff because it's under their umbrella to promote their own stuff. So it's like we have done that in the past, like big like multi-city tours and stuff to do books and stuff. And at conventions, we'll generally do book signings and stuff. Because
do you do panel at Celebration about this stuff? Or
we have in the past.
What's the nerdiest question you've ever been asked? Like like somebody would just ask and you're like, man, we didn't think about this. Because
I don't remember a specific question, but the panel that I was on that I would say probably had the nerdiest questions was a panel on the Star Wars for the Star Wars Essential Atlas book I worked on, which like mapped out where all the planets and systems and stuff in the galaxy were.
Oh my gosh.
And it's like that was a horribly nerdy book to work on. It was awesome. Like but man, that was so much time. The crowd that book was targeted toward, and I include myself in this group, so I don't mean to be making fun of people that aren't me. But like, we're the people that want to know like how far a NOAT is from Bespin. It's like,
yeah,
it's like, how did you get there? What's the hyperspace route to get
between? Or like the parsecs thing, you know? It's like you always heard that line of like, it did the Kessel Run, you know what I mean? And then you're like, somebody says, well, parsecs are distance; they're not a measure of time. And I'm like, what? Like, even I don't know this stuff. And then it becomes like,
that was one of the things for that book, for that Essential Atlas. Like, I did a map of the Kessel Run for that book, and it slightly informed some of the stuff they did in the movie, I think. I
mean, that's amazing.
But it, like, they did it a different way in the movie, which I thought worked way better. But we were trying to, for the book, we were trying to do like this path thing and like black holes and craziness and the Maw and all, yeah, like all that stuff in the book. And it's like, at the time of doing the Essential Atlas, like that was that particular one, the Kessel Run, because it's just the throwout line in Star Wars. Yeah. But it's Han. Like,
yeah,
he throws that line out and like it's just a garbage line. It's just, yeah, like tossed it out. Nobody cares. But when it came time to do the Essential Atlas back then, it's like that was one of the illustrations I got assigned. Like just the weight of that,
yeah.
Like, oh wow! I mean, yeah. You can't just knock that out. That's not like that's right. Not a Tuesday evening the night before it's due illustration. That's like you spend weeks thinking about that. Like, how am I going to make sense of this?
Neil deGrasse Tyson, and
it's like, yeah, like, and like, yeah, pouring through. Like, thankfully, like part of my general nerdiness, I took astronomy and space physics classes in college as an elective because I thought it was fun. So, like, but, like, I'm pulling out books from that class, like, going, well, how fast do you have to move and how far from the event horizon of a black hole do you have to be? And, like, how's that going to play here? And how would that affect a nebula that forms around it? Like,
oh, my gosh.
So, like, those sort of things are all, like, it's the part of the, like, the melange of crap in my head that has to, like, plays into this sort of stuff.
Wow. So, did you have a 78-foot? Millennium Falcon going through that, or was it?
I just figured mass. Mass and velocity. You didn't need a size.
Okay. So the satellite was different, right, on the original. So why did they change that?
The dish?
Yeah.
It's different in Force
Awakens. You gotta buy the book and read it to find out.
No spoilers.
According to lore, right?
Yeah, there are a ton of modifications. In the book, we're getting to show photos in this book, and I will page through them for you guys here. The listening audience will have to go find them on their own.
Yeah.
But you guys at the
buy this book.
At the end of the movie.
This is not a commercial, by the way.
At the end of the movie, when Han gets the spoilers, sorry, Han gets the Falcon at the end of the movie.
It's
beat up.
Banged up, yeah.
But Lando, so that was some of the other fun of talking to the ILM guys is they're as crazy about all this stuff as we are, and they love the Falcon and want to, like, explain things. So, if you don't know this, in A New Hope, the Millennium Falcon only has three landing gear. It's got two in the rear, and then one centered in the front. In Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi, it has five. It has two in the back, kind of two... Like, the same one all the way up front, and then two kind of back and forward. So, they wanted to explain that difference from New Hope to Empire. And why, and Lando's ship has five. So, Lando's version of the Falcon has five. So, they wanted to explain why Han's, that we see at the very beginning of, or in New Hope, only has three. So, the scene where they're chasing or being chased by TIE fighters through the Carbonbergs and Han like slams it down and does a skid, you see the front, the two that aren't there in New Hope, the two landing gear rip off in that scene. And then at the end of the movie the Falcon like flies up and away, and they made sure that it rolls so that on screen you see the bottom of the Falcon and can see that it only has the three at that point. And for this book, we got to show some turnarounds of the Falcon from ILM that they did based on the different states of decay or repair of the Falcon. Wow. that show how it was at the very end of the movie when Han gets it, where it still has those missing landing gear, but it has all the other panels off. And like you start to see kind of the Falcon transitioning to what Han has it as.
All right. I have so many questions, but I know we have to start wrapping up. So let me ask you one more. What's Skywalker Ranch like? You're wearing the hat. You told me you've been there a bunch of times. Is it as magical as I would hope it would be?
It is. Every time you go there, it doesn't change. It's like, the people I know that work there say that, like, that every day it's like, wow, we're here. Like, and I've stayed there. I've stayed at the inn when we're working on stuff out there. And it's ridiculous. Like, when you can get on a bicycle and ride around and you're out there at Mecca for Star Wars fans, it's like...
And that's then, a tough like, invite. Now, that's out in the country?
It's north of San Francisco.
Okay. So, what's that that's like, kind of like at the base of the Golden Gate Bridge?
That's the Presidio. That's where everything's based now. Well, and when George sold stuff to Disney, he held all the physical stuff at the ranch. Like, the ranch is his. It doesn't belong to Disney. So it's a whole different company now than Lucasfilm. But they have a working relationship because the physical props from the original movies are still there. Like, those belong to George, and they're housed in the archives at the ranch. And I don't know what the agreement was, but it's still available if you have a legitimate need. Like, there's the availability of that resource as like reference.
Luke's land speeders parked there?
It's in the building, yeah.
Wow. I need to come up
or with it's on, or it's on need. Or it's on tour. And
that ended up one other question. When you're watching another fandom, say Marvel or Battlestar Galactica or whatever, do you ever look at their ships and technology and you go, hmm, I wonder, does that distract you at all? Or are you just, this is something different, I can enjoy this in a different way than when you're watching Star Wars and having to worry about how everything works?
That's all distracting. That's the downside of this, is that all that stuff anymore, it's like I don't look on it with the eyes that I did. Because I'm looking at
comedy and movies and everything. Like, I'm constantly trying to guess what the punchline's going to be. Yeah. My brain is just wired that way of, like...
Right.
Like, I see it analytically instead of just being able to enjoy it.
Well, it's like you watch the movie and you're like, oh, the scene that John worked on is coming up. What did he do? And then, like that sort of thing. And it's like, oh, he mentioned that, like, you can see the glitch in this scene. Like, oh, I want to find it. Like there's that sort of thing where you just start overanalyzing stuff. And I still manage, usually, to pull myself out of that kind of analyticalness most times and just enjoy the ride. And then it'll be, like, the second, third viewings are where, like, I sit down and I start, like, picking it apart. Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, did you see that? Oh, come on, guys. Like...
Well, you got your pilot's license.
You didn't realize Yoda had an upper lip appliance? Come on.
You have a pilot's license?
I do.
And so did that stem from, like how does that play into the whole obsession with ships in the Star Wars capacity?
I don't know that it... I mean, it's probably all out of the same... It's probably all out of the same root. It's probably not necessarily tied to each other, but I do have a set of Millennium Falcon dice to hang in my airplane, so...
Of course you do.
There you go.
That's awesome.
So now, is there a team... Like, okay, everything you... It looks like you've done is based on mechanical, scientific ships and stuff like that. Is there also a team that's doing, like, anatomy? Like, say, you know, dissect the Sarlacc pit or, you know, Jabba the Hutt. You know, like, how many hearts does Jabba the Hutt have or where's his lungs or... Is there any kind of, like, medical anatomy of, like, beans?
Yeah, I mean...
What you're doing
or is that a spin-off of... Or
you there are, like, oh. I mean, we're not doing that, but there are other people doing that sort of thing. There's, like, there's some great, like, Wildlife of Star Wars books. So...
Yeah. Wow. Now, have you thought about Boba Fett's jetpack and how he escaped from the Sarlacc pit? Because... There's no way that...
stay tuned for my illustration for Star Wars Celebration in Chicago next
year. Something like that. It's like, yeah, they kill the guy off, and then what? They figure out he's pretty popular 20 years later, and people are like, man...
There's a weird fascination, but they never seem to happen in real time, you know? Darth Maul's another one where it's just like, you know, they built him up as a huge villain in Episode 1, and then he didn't make it past Episode 1, but now people are obsessed with the character, and, you know, they've touched on it so much in the cartoons, and, like, that's why I always wonder, like, what the next thing is going to be. And that's the other thing, you know, like, when you hear people bash The Last Jedi, or, you know, they say, like, oh, The Force Awakens was just A New Hope redone, but then they get mad at Rian Johnson for doing something different in The Last Jedi. It's right. Like... My defense of all that is I look at my 7-year-old son watching The Last Jedi, and it's his favorite Star Wars movie, and I honestly believe that in 30 years that Kylo and Rey and Finn and Poe are going to be his Vader and Leia and, you know, Luke and Han. And so are you able to separate your childhood? Does that make you work harder to preserve, like, you know...
Yeah, I mean,
the way you felt about it as a kid, or do you adapt with what the job calls for?
It's it's a constant negotiation in my head.
Yeah.
It's like where do I compromise
being a fan, like, and an employee?
Yeah, well, and it's like you have that conversation in your head where you're like, this is just a movie. Come on, and it's like I don't need to spend 4 hours figuring this out. It's like, okay, we just got to move past this. Let's it doesn't have to make sense. It is. It just is. It's but then there's things like, well, okay, we got to figure out the parsec thing. All right, that's an issue. Like, let's figure it out. Like, and like some stuff becomes harder issues than others, and it's like you don't want to ruin something by trying to explain it.
Yeah.
I feel like is where it is in my head. It's like,
yeah,
if it
if you're gonna screw it up by trying to fix it, don't fix it. Just let it be weird and
let people come to their own conclusions.
And let it be the childhood thing. Yeah. So.
They used to say, take you youngsters back to the Star Trek days. One of the key things they decided on in Star Trek was, look, we don't have to explain everything. When Wyatt Earp shoots a six shooter, he doesn't explain how a six shooter works. He just shoots a six shooter. Same thing with Captain Kirk shooting a phaser. And you know, stun, kill, that's all you need to know. Sorted.
Right. Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. All right, so we'll wrap it up. But I thank you so much for being on the show with us today.
Anytime.
I could do this all day, and I will if you let me. But
sorry, we can go to lunch after this.
How do people locally, especially, keep track of what you're doing? And then you know,
Facebook is. I try.
On Wikipedia.
I did see that. Am I?
Yeah.
Yes. I should probably go moderate that. I don't know what people are saying about
me there.
And
you also have a big hand in the Star Wars Day every year. I don't know if you're still doing that event or
we
not.
We do a charity fundraiser thing for May the 4th Be With You at the Brew House, where we get a bunch of artists to do one-off art, which has been amazingly successful. We donate a ton of money to charity from it. And a lot of people get a lot of really amazing Star Wars art for cheap. It's a unique event, but the Brew House in Walnut Hills has sponsored it, and they're good friends. And they've been amazing about it. So we're planning that again for next year. So May the 4th, it'll be right around then. But
and you'll be at Celebration?
I'll be at Celebration up in Chicago, working on a new print for that to sell there. Not sure whether I'll have my own booth or whether it'll be in the art show. I would assume we'll be there signing books at some point.
Which, if you're a Star Wars fan,
there'll be a new additional book out by then.
Okay, and that's that you haven't.
They haven't announced that one.
Okay, so if you have not been to Celebration, it is. If you're a Star Wars fan, whether you're a tiny Star Wars fan or a diehard Star Wars fan, it is the only place to go.
It is, and it's got an extra day this year.
Yeah, it's got an extra day. I mean, you're talking autographs. Art, tattoos, old toys, new toys. You can help. They always have a diorama that you can help build. Be a part of building. My son got to do it. They did a Death Star diorama in Orlando. So
well, it's such a great event because everybody there is a Star Wars fan, including the people that are there that work on it. And everyone's approachable. It's like, I mean, there'll be people that you have to go through a line to get to.
Yeah.
But if you see them at a bar, like most of them are happy to like talk to you and stuff. It's amazing. It's
you're talking about Timothy Zahn. He was there and
You'll see people just wandering the aisles that you would never expect to see. So the ILM guys, a lot of the old time ILM guys will be there just wandering around.
Yeah.
And like, cause they're, it's one of the things about being a creator on Star Wars stuff is that a lot of times your face isn't out there. So like you can go to these things and wander around, and the people that want to find you can find you.
Yeah. Find Joe Johnston and talk to him about.
Yeah. But I mean, Lauren Peterson will probably be wandering around. Campbell.
All those guys. Yeah.
And most of the time they're happy to be recognized and talked to.
And
you saw JJ, right?
He had a fleet of security around.
JJ and Kathleen both, and Bob Iger. I saw in Anaheim, totally by chance, and my nephew, whose name is Luke, got a photo with him, and JJ gave him his hat. I mean, it's if you like Star Wars, Celebration is the place to go. And
JJ took his hat off and
gave it to my nephew. Yeah. Yeah, it's a hat you can't buy it, and I'll save that story for Chris. I think he'll appreciate it. But
sounds like its own episode.
But it's in Chicago next year in April, so it's an easy drive, and it's going to be fantastic. And so, all your books are they Amazon?
Amazon, yeah. You can search for me on there, and they'll all show up or should, and so. But I've got a Facebook page.
Yep.
Yeah, Facebook page that I try and put stuff on. I'm not usually as good as I should be.
It's facebook.com/
We'll put a link up in the blog.
All of it will be.
I think it's like Chris Reif creates or something like that. Yeah. It's my artist page.
While I'm thinking about it, it's easier probably if you go to, if you're not listening to this directly from Podbean, to go to our Podbean page. Since you're sure it's Podbean, and that'll take you to the Podbean page, and that's where I'll have all the episode notes, because it's hard to dig through our blog on Cincy Shirts, because you have to dig through a lot of sales and all other stuff. So, as I'm thinking about it,
probably put up search words that would come up in the search.
We'll figure it out.
Yeah, we'll figure that out. Just trying to be as user friendly as possible.
Support this man. He's local, which is, I find the most fascinating off of anything. Like, it's, you know, someone with the history that I have with Kenner Toys, and like to learn that somebody locally still has a hand in this stuff is just very inspiring for me. And I think it's awesome. And
another thing in Cincinnati that no one had any idea was here.
Yeah.
And done right here locally.
So get Chris's books, get his illustrations, go out and support the May the 4th event he does. It's a really cool event. And just follow him online and all the stuff he's got going on. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you guys.
Promo code.
Of course.
Promo code.
I'm so excited. I almost forgot. And I'm always the one who remembers.
I'm sitting here trying to guess it, but go on.
So every episode we ask our guests to give us a word that people can type in. That word will save them 20% from now until our next episode comes out. So if you were going to give us a word for this episode, what would you like it to be?
How about coaxium?
All right.
I love when people have to work for it.
All right.
Coaxium. If you don't know it, look it up.
You're going to have to. I will.
Type it in. You'll save 20% online between now and the next episode, or stop into one of our three locations and mention coaxium, and you'll get a nice discount. So,
sure.
Chris, thanks again, man.
Yeah, thank you guys.
Awesome. Chris Reif, the Star Wars YT-1300 Krillian Freighter Owner's Workshop Manual is out, and it is an update of sorts of the 2012 Millennium Falcon Manual. As Chris explained, the two books cover two different time periods in the Millennium Falcon's history, and it's one of those things you could look at for hours and hours, literally. It's available wherever you get books, of course, and if you go to our blog and look at the post for this episode, you can see some excerpts from it. I grabbed some of those using my internet machine here, as Emo Phillips would call it. And as always, we invite you to plunder the Cincy Shirts podcast archive. Lots of great episodes out there. John Kieswetter talking about WKRP, Amy Yazbek off of movies and TV, talking about some of her experiences in showbiz. Dean Gregory from Montgomery Inn has some great stories about Bob Hope and George Bush and James Brown and all the people that have visited that restaurant over the years. Frank Marzullo, Randy Rico, Johnny Bench, Bronson Arroyo, just all kinds of folks have been on the show. So go back and listen to those one by one, and be sure to tell all your friends and loved ones about the show, including folks who may have moved out of the area and still miss Cincinnati, though, and still want to stay connected to the tri-state. Now, today's show is produced by me, with some help from Josh and Darren. Our theme music is Cincinnati by Big Nothing. They are from Philadelphia. You can find their music on iTunes, Spotify, and wherever else you get your music. Find vintage tees from great places like Boston, Phoenix, Pittsburgh, Louisville, Seattle, Philadelphia at oldschoolshirts.com. We have a lot of defunct teams, old shopping centers, restaurants, things like that. Kind of like Cincy Shirts, but just done for other cities. In case you missed it, the promo code for this episode is coaxium, and I spelled it right before I even had to look it up, so it's just like it sounds. But you may have to Google it to make sure you have the right spelling. I can't give too much away here. You can do it all lowercase or uppercase. That part doesn't matter. Either way will work. Use that to take 20% off your entire CincyShirts.com or OldSchoolShirts.com order. And of course, you can also use that in our physical brick and mortar stores in Over the Rhine, Hyde Park, and now Loveland. Follow our social channels, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and Snapchat for the latest Cincy Shirts news. Tell your friends about the show. Give us a review wherever you get the podcast from. And as always, download or stream us next time. Bye.